Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 8.
Thomas also discusses the counterparts of virtue, the vices, which include uncaring ignorance, sloth, negligence, injustice, and malice.
Three things are found to be contrary to virtue. One of these is sin, which is opposed to virtue in respect of that to which virtue is directed, namely the good. For, properly speaking, sin denotes a disordered act, even as an act of virtue is an ordered and fitting act. While in respect of that which belongs to the essence of virtue directly, its contrary is vice, because the vice of a thing seems to consist in its not being disposed in a way fitting its nature.
Throughout the Summa, Thomas speaks of man and God, but the communal nature of his thought is evident all along. Human society is situated within the community of beings, but whereas nature is a domain of more or less determined laws, the free character of human association calls for its own kind of law and government.
Man is, by nature, a social animal. Now, a social life cannot exist among a number of people unless someone presides who is to look after the common good. For many, as such, seek many things, whereas one attends only to one. That is why Aristotle says that wherever many things are directed to one end, we shall always find someone at the head directing them.
Near the beginning of his treatise on law, Thomas asks whether law is an affair of reason. In answering, he formulates a famous definition.
Law is nothing other than a reasonable directive, directing beings toward the common good, promulgated by the one who has the care of the community.
In discussing God's providence in the first part of the Summa, Thomas made a related point.
The whole community of the universe is governed by the divine reason. Therefore, the very notion of the government of things in God, the ruler of the universe, has the nature of a law. And since the divine reason's conception of things is not subject to time, but is eternal, therefore, this kind of law must be called eternal.
He then develops three subordinate kinds of law from the eternal law. There's natural law, which is inherent in the kind of beings humans are. There's human law, which is what we normally mean by the kind of positive law that legislatures pass and courts pass upon. And there's divine law, the revealed law, the old law of the Old Testament and the new law of the Gospel. Natural law tends to remain general and implicit. Human and divine laws are intended to provide more detailed guidance and complete the fabric of social directives. Thomas also puts the question whether there is in us a natural law. He gets his answer from eternal law, based on the idea that human reason participates in God's providence.
Now, among all others, the rational creature is subject to divine providence in a more excellent way, insofar as it itself partakes of a share of providence, by being provident both for itself and for others. Therefore, it has a share of the eternal reason, whereby it has a natural inclination to its appropriate activity and end. And this partaking of the eternal law in the rational creature is called natural law.
Thomas knows that different peoples have different customs, but he also upholds the notion that human nature is commonly shared and that human needs are everywhere similar. So the philosopher's task, then, is to identify and describe the fundamental ways in which we do good and avoid evil. Thomas believes we are called to follow God's intention that we do good and avoid evil. These basic directives, written into the very heart of man, are the primary precepts of natural law. Thomas says that in natural law, there's first a general directive to preserve ourselves. This command holds for groups as well as for individuals.
The order of the precepts of the natural law is the same as the order of our natural inclinations. For there is in man a primary and natural inclination to good, which he has in common with all things, inasmuch as everything desires the preservation of its own being according to its nature.
Thomas continues,
there is in man a second inclination to more specific ends, according to the nature he has in common with other animals. According to this inclination, those things are said to belong to natural law, which nature has taught all animals. Instincts such as the joining of husband and wife, the education of children, and so forth.
The human character of Thomas's examples may surprise us, but it reminds us that even our animal tendencies are part of our human nature. They fall under the law of human nature. Of course, there's also the natural human tendency to follow the dictates of reason.
Third, there is in man an inclination to good according to the nature of his reason, and this is proper to man alone. Thus, man has a natural inclination to know the truth about God and to live in society. And in this regard, whatever belongs to this inclination comes under the natural law, as, for example, to shun ignorance and to avoid offending those with whom one has to live, and other similar things associated with such an inclination.
From these primary precepts of natural law, other more definite directives can be formulated. Many of them are embodied in proverbs, sayings, and maxims, but humans also need particular rules to guide them towards the good of the common life. This is the domain of positive human law. While recognizing the benefits of human law, Thomas also recognizes its limitations. As to whether human laws ought to prohibit all vices, he says,
the human law ought not to prohibit all those vices from which the virtuous abstain, but only the more serious ones from which the majority may be expected to abstain, and above all, those which are harmful to others and which threaten the continued existence of society itself, such as murder, theft, and the like.
But Thomas cautions that the governing power is not the private preserve of anyone.
Law, properly speaking, has as its first and foremost purpose the ordering of the common good. Now, to order anything to the common good belongs either to the whole people or to someone who is delegated to act on their behalf. Hence, the making of a law belongs either to the whole people or to a public personage who has responsibility for the whole people.
How should political and legal power be structured? Thomas favors a mixed polity of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy.
Everyone should have some part in the sovereignty. In this way, the peace of the people is preserved, and everyone loves and protects such an arrangement. Hence, the best system of government is found in a state or kingdom in which one person is placed in authority to preside over all in accord with virtue. Then under him are others ruling in accord with virtue. Yet such a government belongs to all, both because they can be elected out of all and because they are also elected by all. Indeed, such is the best government, well formed by a mixture of kingship, in the sense that one person presides, and aristocracy, in the sense that many rule virtuously, and democracy, in the sense that leaders can be elected from among the populace, and further, that the choice of the leadership belongs to the people.
Here Thomas rationally justifies the structure of legitimate authority, and he also describes how we should seek the good of the whole community. For example, sedition stirs up division and rebellion, and Thomas agrees it's a grave evil. But if there's a tyranny, he says that rebellion is not seditious.
The rule of a tyrant is unjust because it is directed not to the common good, but to the private good of the ruler. Therefore, the overthrow of this kind of government does not have the character of sedition, unless perhaps it produces such disorder that the society under the tyrant suffers greater harm from the resulting disturbance than from the tyrant's rule. Rather, it is the tyrant who is guilty of sedition, because he spreads discord and division among the people under him, so as to control them more securely. It is characteristic of a tyranny that it is directed to the personal interest of the ruler and to the harm of the community.
Interestingly, Thomas's concern for the common good is nowhere clearer than in his defense of private property. He finds that taking a moderate profit is reasonable, and he explains why it's best that individuals acquire, own, control, and dispose of private property. But then he turns from the right to possess property to discussing the question of use. Here he differs.
Each man should not hold external things for his own use, but for the good of the community, so that each one should readily share things with others in need.
And further,
what belongs to human law cannot cancel what is required either by natural law or by divine law. Now, according to the natural order founded by divine providence, material things are ordered to the alleviation of human needs. Therefore, the division and ownership of things ordained by human law must not interfere with the alleviation of human needs by means of those things. And so, whatever a man has in superabundance is owed of natural right to the poor for their sustenance.
Thomas places the primary obligation on the judgment of the individual who has resources, but he says that an endangered person might take what he needs without committing fraud or robbery.
If, however, there is such urgent and obvious need that there is clearly an immediate emergency for sustenance, as when any person is immediately endangered and without means of alleviation, then he may legitimately take from another person's goods what he needs, either openly or secretly. Nor is this, strictly speaking, fraud or robbery.
In particular social issues, Thomas, like every great thinker, is in part bound by his times and in part not. Many of his views on how Christian believers should relate to unbelievers and heretics were accepted in their time. They're simply unacceptable today. For example, he was concerned with regulating the dress of the Jews, but he opposed those who would force Jews to convert to Christianity.
The practice of the church never held that the children of Jews should be baptized against the will of their parents. Therefore, it seems dangerous to bring forward this new view that, contrary to the previously established custom of the church, the children of Jews should be baptized against the will of their parents.
Thomas says that religious conversion cannot be forced because faith cannot be forced. Here he includes Gentiles, mostly Muslims, in his argument.
Unbelievers, such as the Gentiles and the Hebrews who have never accepted the Christian faith, should in no way be forced to believe, for faith is a matter of the free will.
Thomas accepts slavery and serfdom, but limits the obedience enjoined by these institutions.
The inferior is not obliged to obey his superior when the latter commands something in matters where he is without authority, for all men are equal by nature. Hence, in the contracting of matrimony or making a vow of chastity or such things, servants are not obliged to obey their masters, nor children their parents. But in what has to do with the appropriate disposition of human actions and dealings, a subject is obliged to obey his superiors in the sectors of their superiority or authority. Just as a soldier obeys his general in matters of war, a servant his master in the tasks assigned him, a son his father in matters included in the discipline and management of family life, and matters of this sort.
Thomas's views regarding women also are limited by the social conditions of his own time. Yet here, too, he seeks a reasonable basis for the relation between the sexes. Women were totally dependent in the society he knew, yet Thomas remarks in another work that husbands have obligations, too.
If a husband were permitted to abandon his wife, the society of husband and wife would not be an association of equals, but instead a sort of slavery on the part of the wife.
But Thomas says marriage is an association of equals for the following reason.
The image of God is common to both sexes, since it resides in the mind, where there is no distinction of sexes.
In the unfinished third part of Thomas's Summa Theologiae, as well as in the second half of the second part, the topics and arguments become more directly theological. Church fathers, church councils, papal writings, and canon law become more prominent. Aristotle is never forgotten, but St. Augustine and other religious writers come to Thomas's assistance as he thinks his way through Christ to the divine Trinity as the end and source of human life. The Summa traces out the great circle by which all of creation proceeds from God and returns to Him, from eternity, through time, to eternity again. Thomas's own thought is caught up in that circle. He observes,
through will and love, a person is somehow drawn into the very things willed and loved.
One of the most original modern interpreters of St. Thomas, Etienne Gilson, describes Thomas's lifelong search to understand, and in his understanding, to love.
It is not necessarily in the silence of a cell, nor in the turmoil of a university chair. It is not even necessarily under the vault of a church. It can also be on the road to Naples that the presence of Thomas can be felt. For myself, I never discover him anywhere so well as on the extreme point of one of those Italian promontories, those sun-beaten rocks whose every crack sustains fresh and green vegetation, and which St. Thomas Aquinas more than once beheld from the shore of the Tyrrhenian Sea. The time is noon. The brilliant sun of a May day sets everything in clear and sharp relief, like the definition of an exacting intellect. Near at hand, everything lies revealed in the clear evidence of its essence, and enjoys the peace of its order. Farther off, the glance of the eye moves toward distances so brilliant that they are lost in their own expanse and disappear in the very excess of the light that covers them. What is more beautiful than this earth on which the source of distinctions is the very same as that of unity? Suspended between the heavens and the sea, some birds look down upon it from on high and glide like angels, until one of them, moving off with a great sweep of wings, answers the call of the sun, mounts, and, cutting the blue with his flight and his cry, rises to meet the light.
During the last weeks of his life, Thomas gave up writing the Summa. His secretary and companion, Reginald, was especially insistent one day that the master complete his greatest undertaking. To his dismay, Thomas answered,
"Reginald, I am unable to do it."
Pressed further, Thomas refused again.
"Reginald, I can't, because all that I have written seems like chaff to me."
Reginald was still insistent. A generally reliable biographer, one of Thomas's intimate associates, tells us that he reluctantly gave his reason.
"All that I have written seems like chaff to me in comparison with the things that I have seen and that have been shown to me."
Thomas had come to the end of his life, but not without hope, for he'd written,
"What is unknown cannot be loved, but it does not follow that knowledge is the same as love, since love is the goal of knowledge. And so love takes up where knowledge leaves off."
This concludes The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston.